Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by an actor and musician who's worked with everyone, basically, from Pink Floyd, Roxy Music, Madonna and Michael Jackson, to Iggy Pop, Robbie Robertson, The Smiths and Kirsty MacColl, among many more. And he's also podcaster on the brilliant Rockonteurs podcast with Gary Kemp. It's Guy Pratt. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right. No, but it's an honour. I've got all my sort of more Beatley friends have said, oh man, no, this is the one. This is the Beatles podcast. You should, I mean, because you kind of really should get Gary somewhere, because Gary is going through such a Beatles fanboy thing at the moment.
Oh, see.
Yeah, he really is.
Ah, brilliant, yeah. Okay, well, if you could put in a word.
I will, absolutely. Well, he's doing a Beatles thing for Sirius FM today. Because he said, and I didn't know if I could detect anything in his voice. It was like, I see you're doing a Beatles podcast tomorrow.
Oh, did he? I must say, you've been keeping us entertained throughout much of lockdown. So we've had your YouTube lockdown licks.
Oh,
which
yeah.
I've been enjoying.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I haven't done one of those for ages, actually. I probably should. The funny thing is that I ask people for requests, and then people request things that I really don't want to play, and then I get really angry with them, which is really, really unfair. Because I tend to be really nice and expansive in my chats and stuff. And I want to be. I want to be encouraging, embracing, and sharing. And then in my comments, I'm just really horrible to everyone.
It's fine.
I know. Actually, I have got to the point where people get upset if I'm not rude. You know, that's
good.
So.
And your Rockonteurs podcast, what was the idea behind that?
Gary Kemp and I are sort of, you know, bezies, and we're always looking for things to do together. And so the last few years have been fantastic. You know, we play together in The Sourceful of Secrets with Nick Mason, which is the most fun thing I've ever done because it's kind of Pink Floyd with a human face. You know, it's like before it became the vast faceless obelisk. It's kind of this fun thing of reminding people of when Pink Floyd were essentially a pop group, you know. Well, actually, that's not true. It's all very proggy. So Gary and I had this idea for the podcast ages ago. So we started recording them before lockdown. But then lockdown happened. Right. So the first sort of seven or so were actually done in a studio with the people. And then we kind of had to adapt. And it's obviously been a fantastic, you know, I mean, obviously would rather not have had any of this happen to the world. But you know, this has been a good thing for that. I mean, we absolutely love doing it. And it's people seem to keep wanting to talk to us. We keep meaning to take a break, but then people keep turning up. So, you know, not as many women as we'd like, but, you know, what can you do?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a definite need for that, I think.
Well, they say no. It's as simple as that. Just like to point out, we have asked loads and loads of women. Yeah, and they tend to say no. I don't know if it's because it's two blokes and they think we're ganging up on them, which, of course, we're not.
I suppose blokes doing a podcast, yeah, I can see why. Having heard of lots of blokes doing podcasts.
Well, I don't know. It's hardly Top Gear. You know what I mean? I mean, Gary and I are... You know, a more fey pair of West End Wendy's you couldn't hope to meet. I mean, really.
Indeed. You were saying about the Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets tour. Are there any plans?
Yeah, well, we've rebooked the tour, I mean, four times. You know, we keep rebooking, and it looks like we're starting... I don't know if I'm allowed to say it. I don't think it's been announced. Anyway, we might...
Don't worry.
No, but I know Europe and the UK has been announced. There might be something else before that. But yes, we are hopefully booked for, yes, pretty much exactly 2 years after it was originally booked. We're doing the UK tour and Europe. So if we can still go to Europe.
Yes, there's the thing. Let's not, that's for another podcast.
No, let's not. No. You follow me on Twitter to see exactly what I think about all that.
So tell me, Guy, when did you first discover the Beatles?
This is something I've been thinking of because Gary and I have been talking about this. The funny thing is when you get into music as a kid, because of course it was in the 70s, so the Beatles were already a thing in the past. The first actual Beatles, the first Beatles rated album I remember was Imagine. Was my dad had Imagine and used to play that. And the first thing I, because of course my main introduction to music was through cassettes. Yes. As a kid, you had cassettes. You had a little cassette player. And the first thing I really knew was Band on the Run, which I still think is a fantastic album.
Yeah.
And then I discovered, and actually one of my first musical memories ever. So I remember seeing the Beatles on Top of the Pops. Must have been a pre-recorded appearance, because I think it was Hey Jude. I think they used to be on it quite a lot, but they weren't on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I absolutely remember Hey Jude on Top of the Pops. So that's one of my first memories. And then Sergeant Pepper, my stepdad, had this fantastic... It was when I first kind of really got into music. I discovered my stepdad had, for some reason, they'd ended up in my bedroom, this collection of albums. And it was the most perfect little précis of the 60s. It was the most perfect little education. It was Highway 61 Revisited, Wheels of Fire by Cream, Smash Hits by Jimi Hendrix, Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Sgt. Pepper.
Blimey.
And I remember playing these albums one by one and just going, you're fucking kidding. You are kidding. You know, cause, like, everyone was just, what?
Yeah.
Because it felt to me like I was listening to the future.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, this has already happened.
Yeah.
And I remember, because the song that actually struck me more than anything, I mean, you know, I'm only about 11 at this point, was She's Leaving Home.
Mm.
For some reason. It just broke my heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Beatles, to me, I mean, I love and adore the Beatles, but Harrison I love as a writer. And I exalt McCartney as a bass player. I mean, him and James Jameson basically together had to write the book. They wrote the book. They invented it. I mean, you know, before them, there was jazz, but the jazz playing, but rock and roll was just ding, 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 you know, and they literally had to invent this form, which they did. So that's my favorite. The first time I met McCartney, right? I've met him a few times, not that many, and obviously I'm just absolutely terrible. I'll tell you the worst one was I was at a film screening at BAFTA. And I went to the loo and I was having a wee. And I have to have that thing sometimes. That thing when you go to the loo and you can't wee. And then I looked, and there was one other person in the loo. And it was Paul McCartney standing at a urinal. And he didn't look at me. And he just went, and relax. But the first time I met him... it was actually Johnny Marr introduced me to him at that fantastic Linda McCartney memorial show at the Albert Hall.
Oh, you were there?
I was there, yeah. And and he introduced me, and it's Johnny said, this is Guy, plays bass for Pink Floyd. And Paul put his arms around me. And he said, Guy, you know what? The thing with us bass players, and all I could think was, us? I'm in an us with Paul McCartney? There's an us?
Yeah.
So,
whoa.
And then the last time I saw him, actually, he told me a rather brilliant thing. For some reason, I can't remember. Paul's one of those people I'll never get over it. I'm always in a mad scramble of just thinking of things to say because you just don't want that horrible silence and having to walk away. And for some reason, we got onto mistakes on records. And and then I just said, Paul, have you got away with any mistakes or anything? And he said, and the funny thing was, he said, yeah, there's a Beatles song called I Saw Her Standing There. I I've heard of it. And he said, no, we got to the end. I thought, we're going to have to do that again. And everyone went, yeah, that's great. He said, I thought, all right. So let that. So apparently, Paul McCartney fucked up on I Saw Her Standing There. But I don't know what. I haven't actually been through it yet with a proper anorak comb.
I was going to say, I mean, so many people on here have been saying about what an amazing bass player, a melodic bass player as well. But from your perspective, I mean, you're one of the most famous bass players in the world. What is it about him that impresses you most?
Well, what really impresses me is the complete compartmentalization of playing those bass parts and singing. Because playing bass and singing is really, really difficult. It's the weird thing. Playing bass and playing guitar and singing is the easiest thing in the world. It's complete. And what's weird is that even if you're doing like a Sex Pistols, right, like where you just sort of the bass line is just the guitar line, it's still somehow more difficult to sing. I don't know why that is. I mean, I always have to. You know, if I was going to play guitar and sing something, I could just do it. But if I'm going to play bass and sing something, I have to practice. Quite a lot.
Wow.
So, but yeah. It's yeah. But the fact that he's that's the thing that's so impressive that he is that they're such incredible. I mean, like for instance, Sting came up with a brilliant thing where he wrote these his like in the Police. His bass lines were so simple but so brilliant. It's like that's a real skill in itself to write something that's incredibly simple, but you can tell the guy can really play. You can tell just by the way it's constructed. But that and those are the sort of lines you construct when you know you're singing the thing. Whereas, you know, McCartney writes bass lines like he's not going to have anything else to do.
So the album we're talking about today is Abbey Road.
Yes.
Why are we talking about this?
Because you asked me to.
Any other reasons?
No, because I must say I'm quite daunted, especially with the level of guests you usually have. That you, because this seems quite a big one. I would have thought I would have been given Goodnight Vienna or something. But.
You can do it if you want.
But it is. It's an absolutely magnificent piece of work. I mean, I can't remember when I first listened to it. Do you know what I mean? I think with Beatles albums, you just kind of, you heard that you went to someone's house and they had a Beatles album and you hadn't heard it, so you put it on. And then, you've just built up your knowledge of them. And they're just this sort of constant background hum. You know what I mean? The Beatles, they were just there and they were clearly the foundation of everything. So I can't actually remember. I remember someone coming round to my house and going and putting Abbey Road on and thinking, oh, I've got Abbey Road. That's cool.
Yeah.
Which I think I probably, because I used to, in the 80s, I used to do a lot of kind of catalogue, especially when CDs came out. You go and buy catalogue, you know, suddenly realize, oh my God, I haven't got all the Allman Brothers albums, or, you know, I haven't got all the Miles Davis records, which is a lot. But yes, it is magnificent and, you know, quite controversial. There's certainly positions that can be taken on elements of it. Which we shall find out.
So, briefly, the album was released on the 26th of September 1969. That was actually 6 days after John...
After John had left, yeah.
Yeah. Or, well, here's some contention already. It was after he'd said, I want a divorce. They'd had the meeting. But there's talk now that did he mean it or not? But we'll come to that later.
But hadn't George already said he was as well?
Well, George had quit during the Get Back sessions. Yeah. John made this statement in September 69. However, when Paul later announced, when he was promoting McCartney, there was a press release saying effectively he was leaving the Beatles. And apparently John was shocked. So it may have been that John was throwing out a statement. Right, that's it. A bit of soap opera kind of stuff. But effectively, yeah. It ultimately turned out he had.
Yeah.
So...
But what's extraordinary is because by this point, they're not even really a band. I mean, it's got to the point where everyone's so bursting with the material. George is now a fully formed solo. I mean, he's got a fucking triple album basically ready to go at this point. McCartney's got an album ready to go. We know John's got all his stuff. And so they're not even the Beatles anymore. They're like the Traveling Wilburys or something. They're like a bunch of superstar solo artists who are sessioning on each other's songs. You know,
yeah.
And then because the idea wasn't it? Didn't John want to do it that one side was Lennon and one side was McCartney, but then slightly Harrison coming up with amazing material, put a bit of a spanner in those works.
Well, that was the meeting they had after the album was released. John's
a bit late for that, isn't it?
Well, it was literally they had this meeting, and then a week later. He quit, but he said, let's have four songs each, and Ringo can have two. And they were talking about a Christmas single as well.
The first thing is dividing the time on the albums. So I said it to you, and I said it to you. And if we really divided it, it'd be four each and two for Ringo. So that's settled. And the Lennon McCartney bit, so that's just between us two. So we'll just do that, you know. It just should be suddenly on the album, if anybody bothered to look, it just said Lennon, or McCartney. So that's that really, isn't it? That's it for the Beatles, isn't it? It'd probably be a good idea, wouldn't it?
This is one thing I find so sweet. I remember when I read that, was that because you think of the Beatles having gone through this sort of amazing transformation and all the spirituality and the Indian thing and the magic and all the madness. But then they still have this sort of lovely mop top side of doing a Christmas single.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Of still being like a little pop group from Liverpool and, you know, something for the fan club and...
Yeah.
I mean, it's really sweet. They were still connected to that.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And they never stopped doing those fan club records,
yeah,
whatever was going on. But it was brilliant because it brought together, reunited with George Martin,
yeah,
Jeff Emerick. And I think George Martin is key to all of this. Basically, in January 69, they've been doing the finishing off the filming Get Back, Let It Be, which hopefully we'll get to see at some point, the new version.
Which is going to be absolutely fascinating, isn't it? Because the whole, but just from that trailer that was put out, because the whole narrative we've been fed of the poison and hatred, and of course all the footage that Jackson's dug up is joyous.
Yeah.
So
I'm convinced it's going to be great.
Yeah.
So Glyn Johns was working on that, and there was an interview with John at the time, and they were saying, "So tell us about the new album," and referring to Get Back, he was saying, "Well, it's nearly done. We've just got a few more tracks to do." So initially, some of the songs recorded for this would have been intended for Get Back. But obviously, that just got blown away for the time being. So then it suddenly became Abbey Road.
Yeah.
But
and wasn't it at one point it was going to be called Everest?
Yes.
Because that was a brand of cigarette, which I don't remember ever hearing. A brand of cigarettes that I think one of the engineers smoked. And then they were going to do the photo at Everest. And it's this thing of, but like, this is where you know it's a band falling apart, isn't it? Because there's always grandiose ideas of like, yes, we're all, I mean, they couldn't agree on fucking track listings or anything, so they're hardly going to agree on. So they go from, "We're going to fly to Nepal," and I'm up here taking the base of Everest, to, "Oh, fuck, let's just go outside, cross the road."
Yeah, yeah. It was literally that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, there's all sorts going on. We won't go too much into the relationships. But, I mean, one of the key things, John, Yoko, Julian and Kyoko, their respective children, they had a car accident in Scotland.
That's right, yes.
So a lot of the sessions, John isn't on.
And then Yoko is installed in a bed.
She has, which they both use, actually. It's not just Yoko. John uses it as well.
Mate, I've got to say, after my 40 years in the business, I think a bed in the studio is an eminently sensible idea. Everyone's always fighting over the sofa at the back of the control room.
But I think along with the tensions, I mean, there were tensions anyway, but I think if you consider some of the sessions would have been Paul, George and Ringo recording while being watched by John and Yoko on a bed.
Yeah.
Without them actually contributing.
But one thing, I mean, I've seen quite a lot of pictures of Linda and Maureen were there as well. You know, it's this kind of singling out of Yoko. I mean, yes, he was, you know, very, very present. Yeah. But it's like, hang on, it's not like the other girls weren't there.
No. Well, you think the White Album, Francie Schwartz was there, Paul's previous girlfriend. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't this big thing that a lot of authors have written about. Yoko was there piercing the atmosphere. I don't think it was. There was an incident with some biscuits, but that was about it. So I was like,
not the infamous biscuit incident.
Yes. Apparently George had left some biscuits and Yoko took one and he got a bit overheated by it. But I think that's
about
it. Mate,
you're the Beatles. You can get biscuits.
So let's crack on with the album, and we start off with a song recorded between the 21st and 30th of July. It's Come Together. And talking of bass parts, I'd be keen to hear your thoughts.
This song can be played in so many ways. It's one of the few songs where I would say the drums are as much a part of the riff as the bass. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's worthy. I would say that was worthy of publishing. I mean, it doesn't work without that. But it's so perfect. And so, and that sk, which is just Lennon doing it vocally, isn't it?
Mm.
And because that riff, that can be played anywhere. I mean, it's a great metal riff. Dun, 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 dun. It's also incredibly funky. It's also, you know, you can do it anywhere you want. I mean, it's fantastic. And it's so tidy. And it's the kind of, and it's a 12 bar. I mean, it's... And it's so slow,
yeah.
You know, it's fantastically slow. It's a very Floyd-y tempo, and of course, well, lyrically, of course, we start off that opening line, which brings us into the Morris Levy madness.
Oh,
which is just insane.
Yeah, you can't catch me by Chuck Berry. Morris Levy was the publisher from Big Seven, which owned the song, and he took John to court. And rather than face a lawsuit, John agreed to record songs that Big Seven owned. Levy had a load of songs by John that he wanted to sell separately, which was the rock and roll album via mail order. Roots, he called it. And there was all sorts of lawsuits over that.
Which ends up with, so he's got to do three... And Morris Levy didn't even write it. He just publishes Chuck Berry, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he has to do three of the songs that he publishes, not even that he's written, and then he just does two of them, and then EMI sue, and then he sues and wins $1,500, and then EMI sue and win $150,000 off him. And meanwhile, Phil Spector's waving guns about. I mean, it's all...
Well, Morris Levy, he did have some connections.
That's right. There was a mob thing, wasn't there? There was a Genovese, yeah. The Genovese fan, or one of them. Yes,
but I think John did get his own back, because one of the songs he did was Yah Yah, but he just did a really crap version of it with his son Julian banging away on a drum.
Oh, right.
Walls and Bridges. So that was kind of his up yours, Levy. But I think the arrangement, it does sound very similar to You Can't Catch Me.
Yeah.
But I think that arrangement, just you would struggle to pick that up.
Yeah, but Here Come Old Flat Top, that's just not, I mean, that just doesn't seem that much of a lift to me. I mean, that's an homage. No. You know,
yeah.
Because was it written in India?
Well, it was actually for Timothy Leary.
Oh, it was for his California governor campaign, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Against, do you know who it was against?
Reagan. Against Reagan,
yeah.
Yes.
It was.
Oh, I didn't know this was a pub quiz as well as a podcast.
Sorry, that'll be my
last
one.
No, that was good. No, because I say that now because I got that one. But Leary's plans were bonkers, but I thought they were great. Legalise drugs and tax them, which is exactly what they're doing now, which is why all the states that have done that are just getting schools and highways and everything they ever wanted. And then you paid to get into the state. Which is, I mean, it's like, yeah, sounds fine to me. Why not? I had dinner at Timothy Leary's house once.
Did you? Tell me more.
I did, yeah. It was an amazing cast. David Gilmour took me as his date.
Wow.
And, yeah, it was amazing. It was like there was Winona Ryder was there, Bianca Jagger, David Byrne. I mean, it was proper. I know, it's one of those moments where you don't really realise. Till I've, you know, it's like, but because I was living in LA and it's just all so mad. And it was after to go, fuck, where was I? I really should have been a bit more present there, paying more attention. The most Timothy Leary thing was at the end of the night when he said, would anyone like some hot chocolate with some heroin in it? I was like, I'm good, thanks, Tim.
Wowzers. When was this? Yeah.
That would, it was 1988.
Gosh.
David had popped over to it's when I was doing the Madonna album, and he came over because he was going to buy a P-51 Mustang fighter plane, but he didn't.
Wow.
Yeah. Simpler times.
Yeah, simple halcyon days.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, the groove on this is a definite.
Yeah, it's more, but like I said, but that drum part is just amazing.
Yeah. And George as well, I think he shines at the end of this.
George on this solo. Whole album actually really is really on it. Something in the way she moves.
moving on to track two. Something.
Right. Something. Which has the greatest key change in a chord sequence of any song ever recorded, which is just before it goes into the middle eight when it does the run up. Ba ba la ba ba ba. And it goes, which is just fantastic. And was it, as Frank Sinatra said, the greatest love song that Lennon McCartney ever wrote. Yeah. But then he actually said it was the greatest. Was it? And George Harrison said, "Well, we probably all look the same to him."
Yeah.
Long haired, commie, pinko. Yeah. But, it's just an extraordinary. And do you know what? The bass on this. This is McCartney's What's Going On. It really is. The bass on this is so amazing. And it's like this weird thing where it's like he couldn't care less and he couldn't care more at the same time somehow. Do you know what I mean? Because it's kind of noodling, but it really isn't noodling. I mean, it's absolutely sublime. And it's interesting how there's quite a lot of cases where he actually saves his best bass playing for other people's songs. But I actually think that, I mean, there's part of that, I think, because obviously I haven't done any writing for ages, but I used to write a lot of songs. So, and if I haven't written it on the bass, I must say it's the bassist, I mean, becomes a bit of an afterthought. Go, oh, yeah, I better put a bass on it. And it's so, whereas if I'm just playing bass on someone's song, then obviously that's all of my input. And then I'm listening to something and really trying to bring something to it. So, and you think, well, you know, it's probably the same for McCartney. it's the same for anyone. All he's got to think about is the bass. And it's because the bass on this is just sublime.
Yeah. It's almost a melody on its own, isn't it?
Totally melody. But it's very, very reminiscent of What's Going On, you know, by the James Jameson playing on that. It's kind of like he never quite plays the same thing twice. Apart from that amazing, that beautiful rundown he does.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Because this was written during the White Album.
Yeah.
During the sessions. And he played it to Chris Thomas. And Chris Thomas was like, why are we doing Piggies and we're not doing this? But Georgie was so cautious about it. And the thing about Something, George really needed John and Paul's help. There's recordings of him asking John and Paul for help with lyrics. He really didn't know what he wanted to do. And it was things like, Attracts Me Like a Pomegranate.
What could it be, Paul?
Something in the way she moves.
It's in the head each time.
What attracted me at all?
Just say whatever comes in the head each time. Attracts me like a cauliflower until you get the word.
I've been through this one, for about 6 months.
You
haven't
had 15 people joining,
haven't I? No. I mean, just that line, I couldn't think of anything like a... Attracts me like a pomegranate. We could have that. Attracts me like a pomegranate. Which is quite important. And in the way she moves. Attracts me.
But there's a great section in the middle eight where he still hasn't got the, you're asking me, will my love grow? And he's throwing stuff to John. And they get a line, which for me is really amazing, where John suggests, what do you know, Mr. Shaw?
I was saying, did you know who missed the show? And to a chorus of, I don't know, I don't know. Fancy Joe, Mr. Shaw.
Mr. Shaw, I got you.
Mr. Shaw.
I'm Mr. Brown.
Hello, Mr. Shaw. Mr. Shaw.
I don't know.
So he was going to give it to Jackie Lomax, who they obviously signed to Apple. And eventually gave it to Joe Cocker, who recorded it before the Beatles, but he released it after the Beatles.
Yeah, because George used to be quite beaten down as a writer before, didn't he? But he hadn't really found his way. But wasn't it some, I think, apparently it was Lennon had said to him, always finish a song when you start it.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And because that's why, and suddenly he's got a triple album. Like, yeah. Fuck!
Yeah, that worked, yeah. But yeah, it kind of surprises me, but yeah, you're third to John and Paul, so you've suddenly got to introduce a song to them. But to be cautious about this, I struggle with that.
Yeah, but by this point, I mean, it was pouring out of him, wasn't it? But George has absolutely found his groove.
John was quizzical, studied metaphysical science in the home. Late nights all alone.
next, track three.
Maxwell's
yeah. Silver Hammer.
Do you know what? I've been thinking about this, that there was a lot of British bands had this thing, right, of having sort of comedy charts, like, you know, the Entwistle numbers on the Who album, yeah. Or, and the Small Faces and the Kinks. They used to do sort of comedy numbers. The only people who didn't, pretty much, actually, were the Stones, who were way too cool.
Yeah.
They'd have wryly sardonic humour in their songs, but they'd never do a funny song. But with the, and like again, when you know, when we look at the medley, we look at the stuff that had to be thrown out or sort of cut down to accommodate this. You think, because there's a lot of these songs with like O Bloody and stuff, where you kind of think maybe it would have been better if Paul just put them to one side and kind of got together with Leslie Bricus or Lionel Bart and just wrote a kids' musical.
know? Yeah, again, during this meeting they had a week before John quit, John was saying, you know, these kind of songs, O Bloody and Maxwell, why are the Beatles recording? Just give them to Mary Hopkin.
You said something about, before you were talking about Maxwell and then O Bloody the Dark. And it didn't occur to me that you sort of said, well, you don't really like it yourself. Wouldn't it be better, because we didn't really dig them, you know, for you to do songs that you dug and for O Bloody and Maxwell to be given to people who
it's, you know, coming after those two songs, it's like, really, we're here? And it's, although it's very, very dark, I mean, it's basically got a serial killer of women. It's like some bleak Scandi noir. Or the other way, or a Brothers Grimm, you know.
Yeah.
Children's story. Yeah. You know, yes, it's technically clever wordplay, and yes, melodically it's fine and everything, but it's, you know, do we really need it? And again, simpler times.
I love the...
I'm sure you got some info for me.
I'm just interested in the... I think a lot of this is the tensions at the time, looking back. So George Harrison said, as you can guess, sometimes Paul would make us do these really fruity songs.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And was that John called it, was it Grannies?
Yeah.
Was it Songs for Grannies?
Yeah.
And it's absolutely, which it is. But it's yes, Paul has those chops and he's amazing at those chops, but yeah, they don't necessarily need to be flexed here. But having said that, it's the same thing as, like I said, you know, there is something to be said for... The Who were the greatest exponents of this, of just throwing something in just to lighten it up.
This is kind of like the Heinz baked beans of Abbey Road.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of or Silas Stingy. Or, yeah. When in fact, we're coming to exactly Silas Stingy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's just Paul, George and Ringo on this. And bear in mind, John and Yoko are watching it. They don't take part, but they're watching on the bed while this is all going on. And it took 3 days, really, to do.
That's right, yeah, he was,
but
yeah,
that's not, in the great scheme of things, it's not that long. But I think if you are lying on a bed watching,
well, it's kind of, I mean, that's 2 days longer than their first album.
I suppose, yeah. And Ringo's comment was, the worst session ever was Maxwell's Silver Hammer. It was the worst track we ever had to record. It went on for fucking weeks. It was 3 days.
But he does get to play the anvil, doesn't he?
He does, yes. And we get a bit of, I've got to say it right, Moog, not Moog, on this as well.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm a Moog man.
I'm going to go with Moog. I prefer it.
This is because again, this is one thing I had to be reminded of. I'd forgotten that, of course, this was a big deal that this album had this synth on it, and it was quite funny because all the synths on it are just a couple of little, you know, little monophonic lines here and there, and beefing up the bass and what have you. I had in my head, I must have been a mini Moog. But of course, the mini Moog didn't come out to like, what, 72 or something. Yeah. And of course, then you see pictures and this thing was the size of a truck. Probably, and they didn't really know how to use it. And you're plugging, you know, it was like an old telephone exchange.
It was.
And just to get, wow, wee. Like, really?
Yeah. But it's so subtly done.
Every time. It's actually, I mean, I really like the use of synth on this song. But it's, of course, at the time, it caused great upset in the press, didn't it? It was like, it was almost like Dylan going electric. The Beatles going electronic.
Yeah, there was amazingly some really not great reviews at the time.
It got terrible reviews.
Yeah.
Terrible reviews. Was it complicated, not complex, or something? Yeah, that was the New York Times or something. You know, that got dreadful reviews. It's really interesting, isn't it, how an album's reviews, when it comes out, have absolutely nothing to do with where that album's going to be in 10 years.
Yeah. And the roots of this go way back to 66, because Paul was driving along and he was listening to the radio. And there was a play on which the Radio Times described as a pataphysical extravaganza. And this stuck with Paul. Track four, Paul again, Oh Darling.
He came in and sang this every day, didn't he, before everyone came in, because he wanted that certain rasp.
Paul said about this, I mainly remember wanting to get the vocal right, wanting to get it good, and I ended up trying each morning as I came into the recording session. I tried it with a hand mic, and I tried it with a standing mic. I tried it every which way, and finally got the vocal I was reasonably happy with. It was unusual for me. I would normally try all the goes at vocal in one day.
I mean, it's a great vocal. I'll say that. It's a brilliant vocal. And it's inspired as much by Reuben and the Jets as by actual doo-wop, isn't it? Because it was a very cool, because Zappa was doing it, so it was a very cool thing to do, that sort of doo-woppy thing. Because, of course, Donna by 10cc is basically exactly
very
the same
much
song.
So, yeah.
But funny.
Yes.
So.
But I think, again, his vocal. You think his vocal on Maxwell and then his vocal on this, that could be two different singers.
Yeah. No, but he really pushed it. I mean, it is a great vocal. Believe me, darling.
The three-part doo-wops in this were recorded by Paul, John and George on the 11th of August, and that was John Lennon's final Beatles recording session.
Because this is something I've only been, you know, I've in lockdown, of course, like I started getting into vinyl just because I've got a record player and I started getting into, and there's all the great things about albums which are to do with like sequencing, like the whole thing of, you know, the last track on side one and first track on side two, how important that is, and, you know, track listings are so important, but you forget how fucking short they are.
Yes.
Just having to get up off the sofa every 15 minutes to turn the bloody thing over.
Yeah.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been in his octopus's garden in the shade. I'd ask my friends to come and see.
Track five, Octopus's Garden.
Which I like. I must say, the opening guitar lick is some of the most fluid playing George has ever done. It's absolutely exquisite.
Yeah.
It's really, really nice. And I didn't, and of course you just think, ha ha, funny, Octopus's Garden. But I didn't realize, so it was written when he was on Peter Sellers' yacht in Sardinia.
Yes.
And he'd read, either someone had told him or he found out about how octopuses actually have gardens.
Yeah.
They move stones about.
Yeah.
Because also you always think there's a possible reflection on fame there.
Oh, certainly. About retreat. You know, Alan Klein, I don't think we've mentioned yet, but he was involved. And I think any
Rondy
breaks...
Rondy Klein.
Yes. Oh, you love the Ruttles too? Good.
I love the Ruttles, yeah. See. People would kill themselves rather than meet him.
It did have a bit of an impact. But Ringo, there were so many business meetings, I think he was saying that's where he'd like to be. And you can imagine him bringing that song in. They're all agreeing, yeah, having to go through all this every day.
And do you know, there's one of those funny little things, also because Ringo was quite the boozer by this point, wasn't he? This was, I mean, you know, he was the party boy all the way through the 70s. And I keep thinking, whenever he'd let us in, and I keep just waiting for the next line to end in gin. For some reason, I don't know. Yeah. Offer us gin. Yeah. I don't know why.
Yeah, George was very complimentary about Octopus's Garden. He said, "Yeah, it's Ringo's song. It's only the second song Ringo wrote, and it's lovely." Ringo gets bored playing the drums, and at home he plays a bit of piano, but he only knows about three chords. He knows about the same on guitar. I think it's a really great song because on the surface it's just like a Daft Kid song, but the lyrics are great. For me, you know, I find very deep meaning in the lyrics, which Ringo probably doesn't see. But all the things like resting our head on the seabed and we'll be warm beneath the storm, which is really great because it's like this level is a storm. And if you get deep into your consciousness, it's very peaceful. So Ringo's writing this cosmic song without noticing.
But yeah, it is what it is. I'm fine with it. I mean, I prefer this to Maxwell Silverhammer, I would say.
It's almost a follow-up to Yellow Submarine. It's like Ringo's version of that.
Yeah.
However, next... I want you, she's so heavy.
Now, this is magnificent. I mean, this is like, it's because that riff is just so fantastic. And it's so kind of, it's prog, but it's also, I mean, it could be Soundgarden or something. It could, you know, it could be a real 90s grunge thing. I mean, it's absolutely brilliant, majestic. She's so... And then there's a real, because I know it's interesting because this point comes up later. Because of Rock on Tours, I'm spending my life down various rabbit holes because of the people we interview.
Yeah.
And because of one of them I've been down, I get a lot of Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac from this. Got a black magic woman. Got a black magic woman. Yes, I got a black magic woman. So blind I can't see. Ooh, that she's a black magic woman and she's trying to make a devil out of me. It's really interesting when you hear, I mean, the Beatles, rock and roll stuff they do, but anything the Beatles do is the Beatles. And it's really weird. It's things like this where it suddenly sounds like they're stepping into a genre. It's like they're stepping into something that someone else could do.
Yeah.
You know, which is really quite... So I find quite affecting. But yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's great seeing the lyrics written down. I want you so bad. It's driving me mad. She's so heavy. Here comes the sun.
Yeah. It's again, yeah, Yoko and Zimt's influence, keeping things simple, the Fluxus, you know, you are the art, this kind of thing.
Yeah. No, but I really get Peter Green. I can imagine him singing it.
Yeah. And again, more Moog.
Yes.
When the remasters came out, you could really hear that Moog. Because I remember my record player just got white noise. But now you can actually hear elements of that. And it's just like fireworks going off near the end. It just builds such a good passion. And then the end, which is just... Huh?
Just oh, yeah. Stops. No, it's just cut, isn't it? Wasn't it like 8 minutes long and it was cut at 7:44? Something like that. But Lennon wanted it cut at that point. And I just don't know if there's some numerical significance of...
There's some edits here. There was one originally from Trident in February that started off, but...
By the way, something I have... Because I've been to Trident and a bit... And where else... I have real trouble imagining the Beatles going to other studios.
Yes.
It just feels weird.
Yeah.
Do you know, the thought of them rocking up, because you just think they walk in the door of Abbey Road and they own it. The same way as Pink Floyd did. Mm. You know, and it's for some reason it makes me feel uncomfortable, the thought of the Beatles recording at Trident. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, Olympic
it reminds
well.
Me of, it's like, do you know, when they moved Top of the Pops from the BBC TV centre to Elstree,
yeah.
and which just ruined everything. I mean, it was still great because you go and look around EastEnders centre and everything, but it was, yeah. but when it was at the TV centre, it was fantastic because there was pubs and there was a Japanese restaurant you could go to, and you were still right near town and everything. And I remember the first time I went and did Top of the Pops at Elstree, and it just felt so weird and wrong. And I couldn't put my finger on it. Wow. And Johnny Marr was there with Electronic. And I just, and he was obviously feeling the same thing. Because Brittany just came up to me in the corridor and went, "Guy, it's like playing football at another school, isn't it?" Oh, look, they got tracksuits. And I kind of have that feeling about the Beatles being at other studios.
Yeah, I do feel a bit of betrayal as well.
Yeah.
How dare they? But what a song. I mean, you know, this is...
Oh, it's magnificent. Absolutely magnificent, yeah. It's one of those things where you kind of wish it had six more guitars on it, on that riff. Don't, you know.
Yeah.
But also, because they were, bear in mind, because it's the first track, they're on an 8-track machine, and it's the, and apparently it was the first, and they're using an SSL, a solid state, rather than a valve desk.
Yeah.
And people talk about the, it's funny because people talk about, yes, well, because of the warmth of the desk. And you go, no, hang on. The funny thing is that after we've had years of solid state, everyone went, oh, no, we need valves for the warmth. And it's like, well, make your mind up. And to me, I can't really, to me, there's still quite a lot of distortion happening on stuff.
Mm.
It still sounds like things are being pushed quite a bit.
One thing we haven't mentioned, Billy Preston as well.
Yes. Now, okay, one thing I've never found out is where did he come into the picture?
Well, they knew him from the Cavern days.
What?
Yeah, yeah. He was definitely playing in those days. That's where they knew him from.
I never knew that. I never knew that.
And just kept in touch.
Do I want it to go out that I didn't know that? Does that make me look bad? Do I want the world to know that? Do people go, oh my God, did you know that Guy Pratt didn't know
that? they're nice listeners. But no, they just yeah. known each other for all these years. And obviously
I love that.
During the Get Back sessions as well.
Get Back,
and he
yeah.
was signed to Apple as well, so.
Of course he was,
they were
yeah.
good friends. And
yes.
He was obviously on Get Back as well, and I think I love what he brings to the music. I really think he just gives something extra to the... Rather than having another session musician, he just brings a real warmth.
Yeah,
without
absolutely.
Getting in the way. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. It's all right. Flipping over to side two, and we start with Here Comes the Sun, just George, Paul and Ringo.
I mean, that's how you open side two. That is how you open side two, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that written in Eric Clapton's garden, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And but again, this is a because to do with all the meetings, right?
Yes, yeah.
It seems like this is basically an album of people moaning about having to go to lots of meetings.
Yeah. I'm beginning to understand why I love it so much. Because George was saying, Here Comes the Sun was written at the time when Apple was getting like school, where we had to go and be businessmen, sign this and sign that. Anyway, it seems if winter in England goes on forever, by the time spring comes, you really deserve it. So one day I decided I was going to sag off Apple, and I went over to Eric Clapton's house. The relief of not having to go and see all those dopey accountants was wonderful. And I walked around the garden with one of Eric's acoustic guitars and wrote Here Comes the Sun.
Yeah, but I remember actually... pointing this out to my son when he loves the, because he loves to use the capo, and one of the greatest things on earth is capo at the 7th fret, which is
yeah,
it's from yeah, because it's perfect. And Harrison was really invented that kind of there's that sort of arpeggiated don don ding 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 ding, you know, that's yeah. which has become such a such a feature of so many things. I mean, in fact, you know, the greatest, I still think one of the greatest riffs ever, which was him, was that one on Badge. You know, he really is a key exponent of that. I don't know what to say about this other than it is just one of the greatest pop songs ever written.
That's about it, isn't it? It's yeah, just perfection. Sure, you know. And no John. John's not on it.
No John. Hang on, I thought it was John. What, hang on, is John on none of George's? Or is it?
He's on a few. Yeah, he's not on this one. It's basically when they were recorded. The earlier tracks, he was still recuperating after his accident. So it's just happened to be this was recorded. It's one of the first ones to be recorded.
Was he driving around? He was in some like a Morris, a really ordinary car.
Yeah.
Which I think is great. Which, I mean, obviously, you don't want to drive around the Highlands in a Rolls Royce painted like a gypsy caravan. Good luck asking for directions.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No, but I love the ordinary. I love that you could still do that. I mean, it's like I always love that stuff of, you know, McCartney painting the roof at the Mull of Kintyre.
Yeah. But after he had the crash, when he finally turned up to the studio, he had bits of the car with him as a piece of art. Just a chunk of car that had fallen off. But yeah, they both had, you know, severe stitches in their heads. It was pretty serious stuff. Yeah, so just the three of them. I mean, this is the, you know, free as a bird lineup, effectively.
All right.
Now we go to the last song to be recorded for the album. It's Because.
Again, the most proggy chord sequence that the Beatles ever did. And it's the Moonlight Sonata backwards, right? Isn't that it?
More or less. That was the idea.
I haven't had a chance to...
I have, and it doesn't
to the
work.
Moonlight Sonata backwards. Yeah, I know. It's one of, yeah.
Well, even at Timothy Leary's house. Something to follow your cocoa.
But it's amazing. But the doubling of the keyboard and the guitar is fantastic. I mean, again, that sound is fantastic. But it's so proggy. Also, when the vocals come in, this really, really obviously there's a Beach Boys reference, which is exactly what Roger was using at the time later, because it really reminds me of The Wall when the vocals come in.
Yes.
Because it's that same thing, it's the Beach Boys, but it's really dark. And I'm thinking of like The Show Must Go On.
I mean, the harmonies on here, they were triple tracked.
Oh, that's beautiful. Which is why they're so... Absolutely beautiful, yeah. Yeah, and I've got to say, when Paul writes his... used to write those sort of rather childish, silly things, but I do find... A lot of John's more, you know, very serious stuff kind of hasn't dated that well, you know, because the world is round, it turns me on. I mean, that might have sounded great in 1970, but it hasn't aged in the same way as I Did It My Way has, perhaps.
I know which I'd rather listen to.
You know, Because the Wind is High, It Blows My Mind.
He was, I mean, bear in mind for this album, he didn't really bring that much. I mean, the only real new song he bought was Come Together, which is effectively blues. The others were old songs that they'd done, you know, back in the indie era. And so he didn't really contribute that much to it. There's a recording of this with him and Yoko, and he's rumbling away on the guitar, doing a very rudimentary version of it, but it is the proper chords.
Oh, right.
For acoustic.
Because the wind is low, it blows my mind.
It's brilliant. It's a brilliant chord sequence.
It is lovely, yeah.
That's it. And it's funny because Lennon wasn't the chordy one.
No.
Paul was the chordy one.
Yeah.
In the same way, by the way, a little to go off piste, something like that, in terms of people getting credit, you know, after Mick Ronson stopped working with David Bowie, Bowie never wrote a complicated song again.
Interesting.
I mean, wrote a lot of his, I'm not denying the brilliance of his material, but there was nothing with more than like five chords. Yeah. And if you listen to the, you know, I mean, like Life on Mars is the most complicated song ever written. Yeah. Basically, everything on Ziggy Stardust has all these incredible chord sequences. Rock, the end of Rock and Roll Suicide is insane.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting in the same way, and I think there's a thing here. John never, this is the most complicated thing that John wrote.
I agree.
He's very much a 1-4-5 guy. He was, you know, he was very rootsy in his writing like that. A lot of sevens. He used like put sevens on unexpected chords.
Yeah,
that was his real trademark.
Yeah. So it's a beautiful contribution.
A fantastic contribution. Yeah. Luxembourg. Deep <Dupont.
laughs> You never give me.
Then we move on to You Never Give Me Your Money.
Again, now this is one of those things where so beautiful. The first bit of it is just so beautiful. It's one of those, you know, this is where that McCartney thing that no one else ever has and ever will be able to do. He's just a master of it. Yeah. It's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, Paul's really not impressed with Alan Klein. He was saying, this was me directly lambasting Alan Klein's attitude to us. No money, just funny paper, all promises. And it never works out. It's basically a song about no faith in the person. That found its way into the medley on Abbey Road. John saw the humour in it. So John knew what Alan Klein was like.
Then it goes into that...
Again, it's another one about money and another one about Alan Klein, and where it starts off that way, at least.
Yeah, I do. I love the lyrics on it.
Well, the out of college section was quite nostalgic as well, looking back to the early Beatles.
Yeah. Oh, but then, of course, it's got the C section, which is we're back into that George type arpeggio badge thing.
Yeah, yeah. Which, after the One Sweet Dream.
Yeah.
This section was written while Paul was in New York with his wife Linda, and it referred to their fondness for, you know, deliberately getting lost in the countryside.
Yeah.
That's a strange way to lead it up to the final arpeggio as well, strange chord sequence.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the way the song plays out with this selection of tape loops and George's rich, sumptuous guitar solo.
Oh, yeah, and then the nursery rhyme. Mm. I'm sure someone's written a thesis on it.
But it's beautiful, and it's just the way it fades out, and then you've got the bells and the bubbles coming on.
And into the cicadas.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant thing.
Very dreamlike.
We're back to Fleetwood Mac, aren't we? This is very, I know, and this has been pointed out before, how it's very Albatross-y, this.
Yeah, John clearly said it was, you know, an influence by Peter Green's Albatross. And George Martin's Lowry organ, George's shimmering guitar with those nonsense lyrics. It's such a lovely atmosphere, such a lovely place to be.
And it's really, really nice. Now, it's interesting, it says... On the lyric sheet I've got up in front of me, it says Italian lyrics broken down phonetically, but the words are Italian, Spanish and Portuguese, aren't they?
And bollocks as well.
Yeah. And I wonder if the fact that paparazzi... Now, paparazzi at this point was a uniquely Italian phenomenon, wasn't it? It wasn't used here until... I'm sure we only started talking about the paparazzi in the 80s.
Okay.
I could be wrong. And so... I don't know if that's an Italian word he knows or it is a reference to being a celebrity and being, you know, followed.
Well, there's all sorts of gibberish on here. I mean, John's succinct summation of this was, that's a piece of garbage I had around, which I think is
But he does that a lot, doesn't he?
He does.
He does like to dismiss things where he wasn't. It's, you know, and I think part of that, in the same way that Dylan does, you know, it's that it's all part of the enigma.
Yeah, I think
the same.
So.
That was bollocks, you know, when it clearly probably wasn't when he wrote it. although this is. let's be clear.
Well, there's the questo obbligato tanto mucho, cake and eat it. So it's cake and eat it. He's thrown in there, and we're singing about the mondo paparazzi, mi amore, chica verdi, parasol, chica verdi. According to Paul, it's a phrase they used to use in Liverpool, which basically means F off. So they would say chica verdi. And they threw that in there.
Chickaferdy.
Yeah.
It's in, Robert Palmer used to do this thing when because he used to love Bossa Nova. He used to write Bossa Nova songs. But he would, because Robert was incredibly kind of sort of studious and hardworking on his writing. And he would do a thing where he would just write down a list of words or just sing words that sounded Portuguese. Wow. And then he'd come up with something that made sense, so it would be in English, but the idea is it would sound Portuguese.
Mean Mr. Mustard.
Mean Mr. Mustard, yeah, Silas Stingy. I'm wondering, I mean, I'm sure loads of people have probably said this before, it's probably a really naff and stupid thing to say, but the keeps a 10 bob note up his nose, is that a Coke reference?
No.
Okay.
It's referring to the actual Mr. Mustard, who was very stingy. And he used to keep 5 bob notes up his rectum, and they changed the words. It's from a news article.
Ah.
And I guess rectum's more difficult to rhyme than nose.
I'm sure if we've got a medical dictionary, you could find something.
But again, it's another throwaway John song, so he hasn't come that prepared, really.
Yeah. And then we're into Polythene Pam. Which is great as a sort of, again, that's a weird thing of that's them almost sort of sounding like someone else, and it's a straight ahead rocker. And there's something about the acoustic guitar on that, which is a fantastic riff. It feels like it's trying too hard, but it's brilliant. I mean, it's a great song. Get a dose of her in jackboots and kilt. Well, that's him kind of like predating the sort of Vivian Westwood punk look by about.
Yes.
6 years.
Yeah. It's regaling tales of various Liverpool people and their particular fetishes. But it's that thick Scouse accent just gives it a real earthy authenticity. Really harks back to the Beatles' early days performing in, you know, Merseyside's and Hamburg's seedier venues. And also resurrects the group's Yeah, Yeah, Yeah.
But do you know what I love about these sort of stories? Is I love that and again, this is... brings me to another point. I love the fact that they're, you know, even with Strawberry Fields and all this stuff, that they're still referring back to Liverpool. They're still referring, you know, because you think they've come so far now, been through summer, but there's still all that stuff still there. But then also, it's a reminder of the thing that's still mind blowing is that this whole journey happened in 7.5 years.
Yes, yeah.
You know, so like, so it's actually not that long ago that they were in Liverpool. You know, it's. You know, people, I mean, people spend that long making an album now, you know, their entire career. I mean, it's...
Well, I think the Red and the Blue albums really highlight that as well. If you look at the cover of both, that's only 7 years and how much they changed in such a short time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. That's right. I remember when I first saw them back to back and it really shocked me in a way that it was, it's like the second one, it's almost like they're mocking the first one.
Yes, yes.
Do you know what I mean? There's something of
yeah.
At some point in our, it could be it's actually AC12 looking down on the lobby for their next interview.
Yeah.
Candidate coming up.
Yeah. Came in through the bathroom window. came in through the bathroom window.
And this is based on a true story, isn't it? This is someone who actually got in through his window. I mean, which is amazing, isn't it, when you think, you know, how to be sort of flippant about it, considering, you know, what happened to John and everything. And it's because the idea of stalking wasn't really a thing, was it? I mean, but I wonder how much of it is based on, if any of it is based on, you know, him talking to her or whatever. But it's a good sort of, again, it's a good sort of jobbing McCartney piece, really.
Mm.
Son is on the phone to Monday, Tuesday's on the phone to me. Of course it's McCartney.
Yeah, again, Paul been to New York to visit Linda back in October 68, and he got a cab on the way back, and he noticed a driver's police identification panel on the dashboard, and it had the name Eugene Quits above the words New York Police Department. So he got the, I quit the police department. And Paul was saying, this was the great thing about the randomness of it all. If it hadn't been in this guy's cab, or if it had been someone else driving, the song would have been completely different. Also, I had a guitar there, so I could solidify it into something straight away. So he's always on the search for music.
Oh, yeah. Okay, here's another one. And now you have to... this might be a really weird thing, and this might just be projection on my part, just because I'm such a who nut. But there's something about the lead guitar in this, especially in the first half of the song. The sound, where it's placed, and the way it's playing really, really reminds me of... I'm One off Quadrophenia. Where you get those blue jeans? They hatch secrets so tight. Where do you get that water so neat? Shoes and shirts are just right. It's exactly the same sort of playing as Pete's lead playing on that, and it's exactly the same sound.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Pete was consciously thinking of that. But also, it's just that sort of country feel. Mm. I don't know, that could absolutely be just me. Whenever I listen to that, I just suddenly, it really makes me think of I'm One.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a lot of stories about Paul and George arguing about, because George was very keen on sort of doing echo guitar solos. So Hey Jude's the famous one. Hey Jude. Down, yeah. Down. And Paul tried to dissuade him. But there's a lot of it going on this album, particularly on this song as well.
What's the one, there's that great bit of footage, isn't there, of George and Giles going through, I can't remember what the bloody song is, and they find this guitar solo.
Oh yes,
yes,
Here Comes the Sun. It was Here Comes the Sun.
Yeah, and there's this sort of and to be honest, it's dreadful. Thank God they didn't use it. And, yeah. it's great when you find stuff like that and then you think, wow, it's great you didn't use it.
Yeah.
One more point about George is that, because the thing that I was always so fascinated is that by this point, he's become much more of a loose lead player with his part. Because what was extraordinary about George on all the albums up till then is the absolute, all his guitar parts were like, there wasn't one excess note. There wasn't not an ounce of fat on anything. And they were sort of such strict arrangement things, you know, and it was like that little bit that absolutely had to be there, and it, you know, it's magnificent in terms of arrangement. And it's interesting how he's becoming much more of just a lead guitarist now here.
Well, it's interesting because he'd been getting loads of lessons from Ravi Shankar as well, and he'd been going to India lots and lots of times, and when he came back, it's weird, he kind of incorporated the sitar way of playing into his rock playing, in his Western style. So I think a lot of that comes out on here because it's very unusual sounds that he's making for a guitarist, I think.
Yeah. Is this the time to bring up the song I co-wrote and produced that has George Harrison on it?
Yes, please.
This was the Jimmy Nail album. I did one with Ain't No Doubt on it. When I co-wrote and co-produced the whole album with Danny Shoger. And for an actor's pop record, it has an extraordinary list of rock guitar legends on it. It's got David Gilmour on it, Gary Moore, Elliot Randall, and George Harrison.
Wow.
And that's because Jimmy was part of that Henley's hit. He was hanging out with George, was friends with him. Also, you know, there's that whole Dave Stewart world and Deep Purple and all that lot. And he said, oh, do you want... shall I ask George to play a solo? And there's this one song had this real kind of soul-to-soul groove. And we're like, God, yes, that would be amazing. My God, are we going to work with George Harrison? And he says, yeah, George says he'll do it. We're like, oh, my God, this is going to be amazing. Just sent him the tapes.
Oh.
Right. I know. Oh. So, but the funny thing was, this was at the time when George was known for his ukulele thing. You know, he had this big thing for playing ukulele. And apparently when you went to the house, went to Friars Park, he just had this big bowl of ukulele. And it was literally like when you come in, you had to pick up your ukulele yeah. and everyone just played ukulele and it was all about ukulele. And he was playing, and when this track went off, I joked to Jimmy. I said, this is great, but you know what? I don't care who it fucking is. If it comes back with ukulele on it, I'm not having it. And of course, it came back with this. And you should listen. The song's called Real Love. And it's great because it's this lovely sort of soul groove. And George does this George slide solo on it. And it's just George. It's totally joy. And you know, you just melt when you hear it. It's absolutely brilliant. But it came back and it had this beautiful slide solo. And four tracks of ukulele.
Go, George.
Which are not on the album. So, yes, we took an executive decision, did actually erase some George Harris.
Wow. Oh,
no, because it was
George.
Real love. Not now, George.
Wow. Superb. Blimey.
Yeah, but we never got to meet him or whatever. I did meet him once or twice.
Did you?
Where was I that? Did. Well, same message, you know, that sort of, oh, hello, look at my shoes. You know, when people say, have you met and so-and-so? It's like, well, you know, I've been in a room and made noises at them. It's not actually...
And urinated next to Paul.
And urinated next to, yeah.
But I think, yeah, he shines on this album. What?
No, he really does.
What I love about this little medley section is when it comes to the end, because we know the album so well, we know what's coming next. For me, that final, oh yeah, has all the tension of the curtains opening in the cinema for the main feature.
Once there was a way to get back homeward. Once there was a way to get back home. Sleep pretty darling, do not cry, and I will sing a lullaby.
Golden Slumbers.
Golden Slumbers. Again, this is that McCartney doing that McCartney thing that, you know, only McCartney does. And it's just beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
No John, initially, at least, on this, because he wasn't around.
Yeah.
Yeah, the song's taken from Elizabethan poet Thomas Dekker. And Paul saw the sheet music on the piano at his father's home in the Wirral.
Oh, that's right, 16th century, yeah. That's right.
And he said, I was playing the piano in Liverpool in my dad's house. My stepsister Ruth's piano book was up on the stand. I was flicking through it and I came to Golden Slumbers. I can't read music. And I couldn't remember the old tune, so I just started playing my own tune to it. I liked the words, so I kept them. Yeah, originally the lyrics were, Golden Slumbers kiss your eyes, smiles awake you when you rise. Sleep, pretty wantons, do not cry. And I will sing a lullaby. Rock them, lullaby. As opposed to Amadeus.
Because I love that. It's that lovely thing of, you know, when lyrics feel like you don't know if they sang it right or if something was an afterthought of that. Once there was a way to get back home, would. It was like, was he just going to sing home? Or is it, no, home's better the second time if you've had an extra syllable on it the time before.
Yeah, and I think it just builds into that crescendo of Carry That Weight. And again, yeah, I think we've got to talk about George Martin's orchestration on this.
Yes.
Which is,
did you hear our podcast with Giles Martin?
Oh, did I? Yes. It was awesome.
God, he was amazing. What a lovely man.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about the Get Back album might be coming out. I think he mentioned it when he implied.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With George Martin's orchestration, the fact that they approached him to help, I think they realised after the chaos of the Get Back sessions just how much they needed him. Because without him, on this record, would be a very different album.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, it's beautiful. But again, hang on, Nan, how long is this? This is Golden Slumbers. That's 1 minute 32. Now, this is where Maxwell Silverhammer starts to look like less of a good idea.
But it's not, I think that's the way they've broken it up.
Do you know what I mean?
Up.
I mean, it's like, why we've got 3 minutes 28 of Maxwell Silverhammer, and because of that, we've got 1 minute 32 of Golden Slumbers. Now, that, I don't know about, that's just not good maths.
But that is only the first section, isn't it? It's not the whole medley.
Yeah, I know, because then we go into something else. Then we're going to Carry That Weight for 1 minute 36, which frankly we could be doing with, you know, another 2 minutes off Maxwell.
Again, carry that weight. It was referring to all the troubles the Beatles are having, all the business dealings at Apple. Paul said, I'm generally quite upbeat, but at certain times things get to me so much that I just can't be upbeat anymore. And that was one of those times. We were taking so much acid and doing so much drugs, and all this Klein shit was going on, and getting crazier and crazier and crazier. Carry that weight a long time, like forever. That's what I meant. What I love about that is the way Ringo's vocals are so loud on this, and you can really hear him honking away on the carry that weight.
Yeah, and the use of You Never Give Me Your Money in that is brilliant.
Oh,
that segue is so fantastic. It's interesting, the rhythm section, you don't often think, but it feels like it's pulling. It feels like Ringo's kind of pulling back and Paul's trying to pull forward on the bass. Paul feels like it's too slow. So there's some tension between the drums and the bass there.
And it's drenched in that George Martin orchestral story.
Yeah.
But I think what I love about that, particularly that section where it goes back into the final reprise of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, the arpeggios, it's just soaked in orchestra and then straight into, and what I love about it, the end, which was recorded earlier, so we have got John on it. So it's almost like all four of them are saying goodbye to us. It's nice to know that he's on this particular track. Yeah, Ringo was never keen to do drum solos, much like Barry Wong. Jeff Emmerich said at the time, the thing that always amused me was how much persuasion it took to get Ringo to play that solo. Usually you have to try to talk drummers out of doing solos. He didn't want to do it, but everybody said, no, 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 it'll be fantastic. So he gave in and turned in a bloody marvellous performance.
And it also, now, there's one thing that's absolutely epochal musically that they do here. And I don't know if this is the first time this ever happened, but they invent the toe-to-toe guitar trading solo thing.
Mm.
Which, you know, which reached its apotheosis in—is that the right word? In Hotel California.
Yes, has that happened before?
Yeah, so I'm wondering. I'm sure someone will tell me if it has. But what's fascinating is that that's an absolute rock guitar hero thing, and it's of all the people to introduce it. And it's all three of them, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's all three of them playing guitar.
Yeah.
For two bars each. I don't know what David, but if you give that to David Gilmour, I don't know what, two bars. I mean, you're like, mate, he hasn't showed up by then.
You got Paul first, and then George, and then John, and they're all sparring on the deck. And you can kind of hear their personalities, I think, through it. Because Paul's very melodic lines.
Yeah.
Then George is very slidey. I'm not going to do it all. But
and John's the angriest, most distorted sound, isn't he?
Yeah. It's his just before that final.
Yeah.
And in it, it's him doing that.
Yeah. But yeah, it's so... I mean, it's interesting how... And like with Come Together... as well, and then the Because riff. It's interesting that there's a lot of big rock tropes that came from this album.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not something you really, you know, would expect.
Well, apparently it was spontaneous, the idea for the guitar solos. Jeff Emmerich mentioned it, and everybody said, yes, definitely. He said, well, except for George, who was a little apprehensive at first, but apparently George saw how excited John and Paul were, so he went along with it. Jeff Emmerich was saying, truthfully, I think they really liked the idea of playing together, not really trying to outdo one another per se, but engaging in some real musical bonding. But they really enjoyed it because Jeff was saying you could really see the joy in their faces as they played. It was like they were teenagers again. One take was all we needed. The musical telepathy between them was mind-boggling. Such was the excitement for this. Apparently, Yoko was about to go in the studio with John, and he actually told her, no, no, not now. Let me just do this. It'll just take a minute. Jeff Emmerich was saying, that surprised me a bit. Maybe he felt like he was returning to his roots with the boys. Who knows?
And the drum solo. I mean, people, it's not a drum solo, but it's. But I love what it does. It, you know what it's like? It's like it's more like it's a polite version of "Won't Get Fooled Again," isn't it? I mean,
yes.
Like, I mean, a lot of fills are actually very much the same. So I don't know if Mooney lifted it from it.
It is, yeah. Yeah, I never thought that. And the only time in the whole of the Beatles' career we actually got a stereo recording of Ringo.
This is yeah, it. That's right. Yeah.
Bizarre.
The thing about being sort of too young is that original stereo thing of something over here, of things over here and then things over here will always sound shit to us.
Mm.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It just sounds shit. It just sounds, why would you, please, can I have this in mono? It's like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, you know what you want to hear in stereo.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I mean, that's the point. It's like, you don't want to go to a gig and have the drums set up down one end of the room and the guitars up the other end of the room, do you? I mean, you wouldn't do that. Or the band down here and the singers over there, do you? It's not what you want.
Absolutely. Also, I love the fact that they're singing, love you, love you. It's almost like they are saying goodbye to us and they know it's, you know, it's, they love us and we love them. I find it actually quite moving, that final section.
Yeah, no, it's very moving. And it's brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. Yeah. And, you know, that great, and yeah, that in the end, you know, the love you, but you know, perfect. That's, again, that's, I mean, that's got to be Lennon, isn't it? The love you take is equal to the love you make. Is that Paul?
Yeah, that's Paul.
I would assume that was John.
Apparently, he had Shakespeare in mind, and he said he wanted to end it with a little meaningful couplet. So he followed the bard.
Yeah, I mean, but what a way to bow out. Although...
Pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a
the hidden track again. That's the thing, of course, that doesn't think there's no such thing anymore. That, I mean, that's one of the things that's a shame, isn't it? No one growing up now will ever know what a hidden track is, because look, there it is, it's on the list. Although I noticed, actually, even on Apple Music, you get the 14 second gap.
It wasn't listed on the original album either.
No, that's right. Well, no, but it wasn't, it just the first pressings of it or something, and then it was listed all. And you'll know this. So what happened? Because they recorded it. It was going to go somewhere else, wasn't it? It was going to go in the middle of the medley.
Yeah, it was going to go in between Me, Mr. Mustard, and Polythene Pam. So that very first bring is the last note of Me, Mr. Mustard. Yeah, they did all the remixes and crossfades to overlap the songs. Paul was there and he heard it for the first time. He said, I don't like Her Majesty, throw it away. And according to John Curlander, who was the engineer, he did cut it up. He accidentally left in the last note. And Paul said, it's only a rough mix, it doesn't matter. And he said to Paul, what shall I do with it, throw it away? But poignantly, he said, I'd been told never to throw anything away. So after he left, I picked it up off the floor, put about 20 seconds of Red Leader tape before it, and stuck it onto the end of the edit tape. And it was this tape that Paul heard later. And it was one of those, oh yeah, keep that. So it's a really last minute decision.
Okay, now there's two. I've got one question about this. Do you know if anyone ever asked Prince Philip his thoughts on this?
I doubt it very much.
I mean, he's basically trying to, you know, I mean, you know, she's a married woman. But isn't there? There's the suggestion that isn't it? Because in the film, isn't there? There's a bit where he comes in with Linda, and John goes, "Oh, it's the royal family."
Yeah.
And so, could that be Paul being aware of that and sending up?
Could be. Yeah. There's also, if you think BBC TV at the time would have ended with a national anthem, so it's almost a. I know it's a happy accident, but it's quite nice sending it in that old close down.
At the very end of their career, they were still loyal to the crown. Even though John sent back his...
He did. Yeah. I think also we have to quickly mention Ian McMillan, who was a freelance photographer on the 8th of August, the cover shoot.
Oh, yeah. Which
is just as an album cover. I think Everest would have been good, but it wouldn't have been this.
Yeah, they wouldn't have had such a problem cleaning the graffiti off. You wouldn't get so many gangs turning up to have their picture taken, would you?
Oh, so many stressed taxi drivers as well.
Because I love those pictures that were taken just before. And there's that old lady chatting to them.
Yeah. She just marches up there, doesn't she? And she doesn't seem to give a monkey's who they are.
Yeah. And I think, but it's funny because down here, because, you know, because whenever I go to Abbey Road, because I do find it extraordinary, still all that graffiti there and everything. And do you know what's sweet? It's down here in Brighton, there's something quite similar on a smaller level. There's down off, just off the seafront, off Duke's, is it Duke Street? I can't remember what the street's called. But there's Quadrophenia, it's called Quadrophenia Alley, which is where Phil Daniels shagged Leslie Ash.
Yeah.
And you go down there and you can, and there's the fire escape, which is clearly the only place you could put the camera. And you can tell, it's like, oh my God, it's here. You know, and there's, it's quite through. And it's the same thing.
Really?
It's the same thing as Abbey Road. It's just like scooter clubs have stuck badges and, oh, wow, and they have to clean it every few months because it just gets completely covered. It's fantastic. I love those sort of landmarks.
Yeah, so the 20th of August, 69, was the last time all the Beatles were together, you know, and they were basically compiling the running order. And it was pretty well there. They shuffled a few
Their
bits.
Families must have been. I mean, that's right in the middle of the holidays.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You think they'd be in Mykonos or, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, and I think they got it absolutely right. It's perfection. But overall, what does this album mean to you?
It is a monumental, you know, masterpiece. And like all great masterpieces, flawed. Like it's that thing I said. By this time, you've basically got three great solo artists capable of doing, you know, and they've just there's too much material. It's not quite enough for a double album if they made everything full length. But you know, I do think, in a way, it's brilliant. I just think there's some great stuff that's been really underused and thrown away, and then some stuff that hasn't. But yeah, you wonder how much of that is just like, oh, can we just get this done? I mean, it's a great monument, isn't it? And that's the way it like you said, it does. It sort of ends it. Yeah, I mean, it's a brilliant record. I'm going to tell you, I love it. I mean, and, you know, I listen to it. And I learn a lot from, you know, definitely. I mean, like Paul all the way through, as, you know, as, I mean, it's, I would, anyone wanting to learn to play the bass, I would just sit down and learn this. It's got it all.
Guy Pratt.
And a Moog!
And a Moog. Not Moog. Moog.
Moog. Moog. I will die on this hill.
Guy Pratt, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really good fun.